Welcome aboard. We will be your guides during this magical journey into the movies. It's the perfect job for us because we love the movies. It's showtime. Ready when you are, CB.
Action.
Welcome to Monoreal Radio, episode number 282. I'm Sean.
And I'm Jackie.
And we are here this week back in the casino. For the first time in a long time, we played Monoreal Radio Disney Plus Roulette. I'm happy to finally be playing this game again.
I am too, because we have stumbled across some great titles this way, but I can't say that this is a casino that we are going to patronize very often, just because the way that Hulu is now integrated into Disney Plus, it was a task to find a title. I mean, we always try and do a movie that's completely new to us, and if we land on something that's a sequel and we haven't seen the first one yet, we'll skip it. And that was honestly the biggest challenge we ever had with Disney Plus Roulette. And now it's a 20-minute search just to try and find a movie.
Yeah. The Hulu integration really muddied this up, but you can listen to our more in-depth conversation on that if you go back and listen to our Dockside chat that just dropped a couple of days ago. But let's talk about the film that we did land on. The Adventures of Bull Whip Griffin. This is a film from 1967. Neither one of us had seen it previously. It was based on a book called By the Great Horn Spoon.
Yes.
Which was published in 1963 and has become like required reading in the state of California, apparently. Like,
no kidding.
It's recommended reading. So the novel is held in high regard. So it's only natural that Disney would acquire the rights to turn it into a film. Very on brand for Walt Disney.
Especially when you consider the time period. This did come out a few years after he passed. But if the rights were purchased during his lifetime, I mean, we know he had such an affinity for the expansion and heading out west himself. I mean, this was a natural adaptation for Disney.
Yes. Well, did they adapt this as well as they adapted other books? Did we land on a hidden gem playing Monoreal Radio Roulette this month? That, on top of many other things, is what we are here to discuss today.
This episode is sponsored by Fierce Fox Co., designers of handmade silkscreen shirts. Fierce Fox has a t-shirt, tank top, hoodie, or crew neck for every fandom. So whether it's the movies or theme parks, princesses or villains, the MCU or Star Wars, everyone will find something they love. The designs range from subtle quotes from our favorite films to iconic characters we can wear proudly, in so many different styles such as sketchbook and concert tees. Listeners of Monoreal Radio can get a 20% discount using the code Monoreal at checkout. Visit fiercefoxco.com to check out all of the new collections.
We are in Boston in 1849, where we meet Jack and Arabella Flagg of the affluential Flagg family. Jack daydreams of heading west to join the gold rush. However, his family's butler, Eric Griffin, tries to keep him grounded. When their grandfather dies and leaves them orphaned, the Flaggs learn that he had in fact blew the entire family fortune, leaving them in financial ruin. So Jack runs away to head west. Eric leaves to retrieve him. They stow away on a ship headed to San Francisco, and Eric takes a job as the ship's cook. They meet Quentin Barrett, an actor who is headed out west as he has a map to a gold mine, as well as the crooked Judge Higgins. When they arrive...
Oh, no. How do you say it?
I honestly don't even remember at this point.
It was one delivery the entire time. Judge Higgins!
Well, moving on from this. When they arrive in San Francisco, Eric makes money by providing haircuts, however, makes an enemy with Mountain Ox, the bully of the town. When Ox gets physical with Jack and Eric, Eric inadvertently knocks him out, becoming the town's hero. Jack tells them that Eric's name is, in fact, Bullwhip Griffin, so the local legend is born. Sam Trimble, the owner of the town saloon, offers a $2,000 purse as the prize in a boxing match between Bullwhip and Ox. However, Eric initially rejects the offer. Instead, he and Jack become partners with Quentin. However, Judge Higgins steals the map. They pursue Higgins and eventually get the map back. As time goes on, Jack and Eric strike gold and the word spreads. Other gold diggers bleed the mine dry, and Higgins eventually steals the gold from Eric and Jack. Back to where they started, they head back to San Francisco to see that business is booming and Eric can no longer compete with the pricing from pop-up barbershops. Arabella, who has been a longtime love interest of Eric, arrives and takes a job as a singer and dancer at Sam's Saloon. Eric, infuriated to see her gawked at, agrees to the fight with Ox as a means to financially bail her out. At the fight, Eric prevails. However, a riot breaks out when Judge Higgins attempts to steal the fight's receipts. A fire burns down most of the original city, but Eric uses his purse to rebuild San Francisco and become a local legend. So, here's the thing. This movie has an hour and 49, I believe, minute runtime.
Including credits.
But this is one of the shorter plots that we've written out. So I'm going to be very interested to see how we kind of flesh this thing out as we talk about it.
Yeah, because I don't want to put the cart before the horse, but I feel like this was actually something that I was struggling with as I was, you know, sort of going through my notes and, you know, wrapping my mind around what I wanted to say. But, you know, I feel like this is one of those odd movies where so much is happening and like nothing is happening. Like the scenes are long and there is so much jammed into these scenes, but not a lot pushes the story forward because, to your point, the plot is sort of pared down and simple.
Yeah, it's action for action's sake, but almost nothing that they do in any of these very long, drawn-out scenes do anything to serve story whatsoever.
Right, and it's not entirely character-driven either, so you don't get a lot of meat and potatoes in that regard, where there's, like, characters that you are really identifying with.
And what's frustrating about that is to start at the very beginning of this movie, where's the natural place to start, of course. It is so incredibly well-paced. The first 10 minutes of this film, I thought, oh my God, we landed on it. We landed on another gem. We landed on another Apple Dumpling Gang. We landed on another Cat from Outer Space, another absent-minded professor. Like, this is a movie that I wish I would have been watching from the time I was 7 years old.
It's a great setup, and conceptually it's brilliant where you're taking this very proper butler and putting him out in the Wild West. So you really think it's going to play for comedy. Before we get into this great setup, though, I want to go all the way back to the opening titles designed by Ward Kimball. I absolutely loved these from the jump. You've got them set to a Sherman Brothers song. So it hooks you immediately, because not just because of the familiarity, but it's just very, very well done. I think Ward did like sort of a rotoscoping style animation.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of like those old Nickelodeon, not Nickelodeon as in the television network, but the old, you know, the crank, the crank machines where you'd watch the movies. Like Carousel of Progress, sort of.
Yes, yes.
But it was that style of just black and white animation, and it looks so cool. And I just really, really loved that opening sequence. And then, speaking of familiarity, you know, we see the home where in Boston where the will is being read. And I turned to you and I said, oh, my God, that is 17 Cherry Tree Lane. And we're going to put a pin in that because there are a couple of other things that are familiar from Mary Poppins. But I was so thoroughly convinced that this was the set. And then I watched Mary Poppins immediately after. I don't think that it's the exact same, but I absolutely think that there were set pieces that were recycled, like the staircase. You can easily identify the banister when they slide down, where the fireplace is positioned in the living room. But the difference is, I think that they were able to make this home a little bit more narrow, because in Mary Poppins, you had the sister suffragette number coming through there. You had the chimney sweep number coming through there. You needed a big, wide soundstage for all of those dances, but you'll see it right away. It's very familiar.
From the beginning, I like the relationship that they develop with Jack and Eric. Specifically, I like what they do with Jack here because they make him very relatable. He is, I believe they say he's 12 years old, if I remember correctly. And what is he doing? He's got this very affluential life, but he daydreams about adventure. He reads the stories. He reads the lore. He wants to go out west. He wants to be a part of the gold digging. He wants to get his hands dirty, work in the mine like so many others were, and sort of pave his own path. It's not unlike anybody else that dreams of adventure, right? We see it in Treasure Island. You see it here. So I love what they do there. And I do like the fact that Eric is very grounded. He's a third generation butler for this specific family. So he kind of he's prim and proper. He's got his rules set in place. He's going to stick to them and he's going to keep everybody grounded. But there's still a playfulness. There's still a childish wonder between the two of them where I feel like Eric relates with him. And I think it's really well done very, very quickly.
I would agree with that. I like the camaraderie between them. I like that it is sort of like an older brother sort of a relationship as opposed to a father figure, because they're going to be out on this adventure and it's not a buddy comedy. So you do need to clearly establish their relationship with each other. Because I feel like if they had done it as sort of a father figure, like it would have been so obvious and it wouldn't have been as fun. You know, Bullwhip Griffin already has the cards stacked against him in the sense of he is very proper and he's going to be taken out of his element. So if he's adjusting, how is he going to parent this kid? So I think that all works really well. The other relationship that I really like that they set up is for a character that we don't even get to meet, which is the grandpa.
Yeah.
Who's got the best sense of humor, that he left everybody, I'm not going to say an exorbitant amount of money because it's not by today's standards, but back then it was quite a bit. And then you come to find out that he sort of padded these numbers because he didn't have it. But what I really like is that he had the faith in his butler Griffin that he was going to be completely unfazed by the amount, and that Griffin was just going to be touched that he thought of him as family and was part of the inheritance. So as they're doing this, it is one of the best sight gags ever in the Disney canon. The will is being read by the lawyer and they keep switching out Grandpa's portrait to have all of these different facial expressions that fit the tone of the room. You know, when people are grieving him and when people are, you know, talking about what a great man that he was, because I thought at first they were setting up that he was such a curmudgeon and he was going to leave them with nothing, which is true, but they just kind of subvert your expectations in the way that they go about it. And I just love this scene, and I would love to know where these portraits are, if they've ever been recycled, if you can find them in the parks, like maybe on Big Thunder, maybe in Frontierland somewhere. I would love to know what happened to these.
I think pulling the rug out from underneath all of them was perfect. I love that they quickly set up that there's sort of this are they, aren't they relationship between Arabella and Eric. And you have no time to really think that much about it because immediately Jack knows where he's going. He's off. They've got to go find him. Eric goes to retrieve him. He's going west. Like the character development and the pacing is incredible.
Especially for Arabella, too. I love that they set up her fearless spirit from the start. She's not fazed that they're penniless. And she is calm, cool, and collected when her brother's gone. And it's just like, all right, we're going to catch up to him. It'll be fine.
I do like the fact that both of them want to pave their own road.
Yeah.
That neither one of them are looking at this as, oh, but all my money's gone. What am I going to do? I feel like now that's more common. Right. You see it in so many. We saw it in Jungle Cruise, which I called back to when they did it in The Mummy. You know, you take the wealthy debutante or the wealthy, you know, whomever, and they fall in mud and they get dirty and they ruin their suit and they get bit by a mosquito. You know, like this is so different and it's so unique. In many ways, I think it's a lot better.
Agreed, because it also doesn't lead me to question, what about the parents? What happened to them? Because this is their grandfather that left them penniless. So you don't really need the explanation of why they're now orphaned, because they're so well adjusted. It doesn't play like there was some great tragedy that happened. And these kids have, I mean, obviously they've gone through a lot because they've lost their parents, but it doesn't seem like they're completely traumatized. So you're not really questioning how they're going to survive, and we can move on.
So we get to the ship. We meet Quentin very quickly.
This set is freaking incredible.
I think this goes without saying, the sets throughout the entire film, as well as the costumes, by the way,
yeah,
they're all phenomenal. This is the style of movie making that I miss. Like, it's all flawless.
Because it's not just the ship. It's, you know, under the dock, and they've got this elaborate setup where, you know, Jack is going to stow away, so they have him go all the way down to the belly to find a porthole. It's really incredible.
But I love the introduction to the rest of our characters. The introduction to Higgins is incredible. You see right away what a swindler he is, what a thief he is when he steals the gentleman's ticket who overpaid to go west to try and dig for gold. Guy basically blows his life savings and the judge bumps into him. He's a pickpocket, steals his ticket. But they don't subtly hide the fact that he did it. They hide it from the victim, but we very much see exactly what it is that he did. Like, so well done. So well done.
He's a shyster from the jump. And I also like how they sort of set it up that you don't know if he's in cahoots with Quentin or not.
Yeah.
Because Quentin is an actor.
Yeah.
And he's also trying to stow away on the ship. So you sort of wonder if they're working together. At least I did the first time we watched it.
And then the pacing dies.
It crashes and burns.
We spend way too much time on this ship. Did he need to become, he being Eric, did we need to see him become the cook on the ship?
Well, yes, but I think we could have set it up a lot more quickly. This is one of those scenes where the pacing is dead because it's very dialogue driven. However, I do think it's clever, and I think that we needed to see how Griffin talked his way into this job, because he gave the captain his word. He was only going on to get Jack out, because the captain is looking for things like what Judge Higgins is doing and looking for people that are trying to stow away. And, you know, I like that it sets up how important Griffin's word is to him, and that he doesn't want to break a promise. And then by happenstance, Quentin actually knocks him unconscious when him and Jack are hiding. And now they've set sail, and Griffin is also stuck on board. Quickly, I want to talk about that scene too, because this is another place where I thought I saw a Mary Poppins prop, a very infamous one. There are, because, you know, we're in the cargo hold, there are quite a few bags. And I thought for sure I saw the carpet bag. Because at this point, too, it wasn't just Cherry Tree Lane. We've also seen Ellen. So I was like, all right, now these films are 3 years apart. How much was recycled from Mary Poppins? And then you reminded me that we knew the carpet bag got lost because it was part of a giveaway where they filled it with cash.
Yeah.
And they gave it away. So my best guess would be that the prop department maybe used the same fabric to make like several of them. And they had a full set, and, you know, Julie Andrews had the one that she was using as a prop, and the rest just became, you know, they were in the warehouse, because in this case, they're not actually props. It's part of the set decoration, because nobody actually picks them up and interacts with them. But it's clear as day. It looks so close to the Mary Poppins carpet bag. I'm pretty sure it's the same fabric.
We could have spent 5 to 7 minutes less on the ship, though. The journey over to San Francisco took too long.
Yes, I agree. Back to my original point. I do think it's important that we saw how Griffin talked his way into being indispensable here and not getting dropped off at the first port, because now the captain loves the food. He doesn't want them to even leave in San Francisco. But I thought this was going to be more of Griffin's MO throughout. And there are a couple more instances where he does, you know, use this cleverness and use his way with words, because he is a very persuasive speaker, to get out of a jam. But I thought that was going to be the whole thing, especially because they're not really playing fish out of water either. He is still in character. He's still this stoic butler. And we don't really see the West kind of rough and tumble him because he's able to talk his way out of it. But I feel like on the ship is the only time that he does it intentionally, where he's in control of the situation, and every other time he sort of happens to fail up. And he'll still, you know, talk his way around things, but it's because something else has already helped him get there, if that makes sense.
It does. Well, we land in San Francisco, and immediately what stands out to me is the set is recognizable. It's that Disney ranch set. It's that Old West set that they used so very often. We've seen it used in so many different films, but it still works. I think it looks incredible. I love the world that they build here with early San Francisco, with the gold miners and the gold diggers out there. And it stood out to me initially. I went, $10 for a haircut in the 1800s is insane, considering most barber shops will still do a men's haircut anywhere between $12 and $15. It pays off later down the road when you see that business is booming because so many people went there. This is at the very start. It's a very limited market. There's a very limited skill set, and a lot of the people that are out there have the 10 bucks to spend because they're mining
gold,
so
yeah,
they can pay it.
No, I really like that idea because they set it up too with the dentist. I mean, when you think about it, these towns are being established. A lot of them are just camps, so they don't even have a lot of these brick and mortar buildings yet. So when you have a skill that's a commodity, like a barber, like a dentist, and people need it, you know, a lot of them did travel from town to town, and it was something you just had to capitalize on while they were visiting.
Yeah. But I think that that works. I like how they introduce the idea of Mountain Ox, how he tries to bully himself into a haircut, how Eric inadvertently knocks him out. Really, it's just a glove filled with gold pieces.
And that's what I'm saying. He sort of failed up.
In all of the right ways. And from that moment, the Jack takes this idea of this character that he once read in a book in the very beginning of the movie.
Right.
Harkens back to the name Bullwhip and says, this is Bullwhip Griffin. And just you hear these stories. It's like Davy Crockett, right?
Or a Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How these legends are born, and are they born of truth? Or are they born of story? In this case, it's a little bit of both. The setup is absolutely brilliant.
It is, but the only thing I wish we would have gotten, you do sort of get Griffin protesting a little bit, and he's like, no, Master Jack, don't do that. But that's it. It's one line. We don't see him go against it for the rest of the movie, and then we don't see him really embrace it either. He just stays, he plateaus here, really. So I feel like we could have gotten comedy if Jack keeps building him up and he can't meet the task, but it also would have created really great conflict. You know, if he doesn't want to embrace this new, you know, legend that's been created around him. So I just feel like we needed something more from the character at this point. And this is where it does feel like the pacing starts to drag because, you know, Griffin will keep talking his way through situations. And in a way, it almost talks himself out of doing these legendary things.
Yeah, because for almost no reason, it's just like, okay, we're partners with Quentin. He's got a map. Let's go. I mean, I understand they want the money. They want the gold. It's why they're there. And at this point, they're already out there, so they should make the best of their situation. Because I think really, at the end of the day, Eric wants to go back to Arabella and be able to set her up and take care of Jack. I think that what gets lost in this is that he still takes very seriously his responsibility of looking after Jack.
Well, to that point too, I think that, you know, you're saying he wants to set them both up. I also wish that we would have embraced his feelings for Arabella a little bit more, because part of this is he's a butler. He feels like because she comes from this wealthy family, he has nothing to offer her.
Right.
And I think that there's part of him that doesn't want to get his hopes up too much with the gold. But once he has it, I think he does feel like he can flex a little bit and maybe there actually is a chance.
And I like the fact that he takes something that Jack had taught himself from reading these books about finding gold and mining it and puts that skill to good use, not only in a selfish manner, but also to kind of build Jack up and like, no, you knew how to do this. You have this. You have a special skill. I like how he builds him up to that, you know, as they kind of progress on. So I think that there's a lot of hand in hand here that's not necessarily written, because I don't think that it has to be. And I think that this is where the screenwriting is very good at times. This is the most frustrating thing about this movie. The pacing is great at times. The screenwriting is great at times. It's wildly inconsistent, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we flesh this out a little bit further.
Oh, I want to talk about it right now, because I think that's where it feels a little clunky, is this transition to them actually in pursuit of the gold. We do get another, not musical number, but we get another song from the Sherman Brothers, and it explains in the lyrics that Judge Higgins, who is now, you know, he's come to town and he's trying to swindle them again. He's been making his way through the area using disguises. I would have liked to see some of that play out, because there's been this sort of cat and mouse since they were on the ship, where Higgins created a diversion and he stole the map from Quentin. Then the stagecoach that Jack and Griffin are on gets robbed. They almost get the map back and they don't. So you know that, you know, they're going to be sort of on each other's tails. And by the next time we see Higgins, it is explained that he's gotten away from them through the use of these disguises, like I mentioned in the song. And then the next time he's on screen, he's in a hangman's noose.
Yeah, I think that they start building this great relationship with Higgins as a foil, and then they completely throw it by the wayside to waste more time doing other things that don't necessitate screen time. Let me just say this right now. And the song, the Ballad of Bullwhip Griffin, because it's the only song, so I'm not going to give it its own category.
It's the same melody, different lyrics every time you hear it.
They do it to move the story forward the same way they do it in Davy Crockett, which I'm fine with. It works better in Davy Crockett, but I'm okay with them doing this here to keep the story moving. I think specifically here, I was going to wait until the end of the episode, but the hell with it. I'm just going to say it now. This is where you can see at which point Walt Disney passed away.
Yes, because it's the see and say with the song.
It's not just, but the see and say, they did it in Davy Crockett and it was fine. You're starting to see where Walt Disney, had he lived through the production of this film, would have tightened a lot of things up, and it wouldn't have been so all over the place. You can see where he had his hands on this story.
Mm-hmm.
Where the story succeeds the most is where he had his fingers in it. You could tell.
Yeah.
And the stuff that gets disjointed and is all over the place and rambles, you can see where this is where they were scrambling. Or this is where he didn't get a chance to cut it down quite yet, and they were just trying to get content out because they didn't know what the future of this studio was.
But this song, in this instance, because we've not seen Judge Higgins, I mean, we did just see him at the stagecoach, but now you're giving us a passage of time through the song. The song sort of feels like a Band-Aid over a bullet hole. Like, it just, I actually don't think you even needed it here. I think you could have showed us the passage of time in other ways, but there's more attention drawing to the fact that you didn't because of those lyrics. And then it's very jarring seeing him about to be punished for his crimes. And it's great that he's getting his comeuppance, but it's not earned because it has nothing to do with Jack and Griffin. To this film's credit, though, it subverts your expectations once again, because now Griffin uses his cleverness to talk down the angry mob into letting Higgins go for a minute so they can try and get the map. And I love the way they go about this, where, you know, we've seen the need for a barber. Now we see the need for a dentist. You don't have a town dentist. Higgins has sort of been acting as one and just pulling teeth. And you can imagine what that's like in the time before they had things like Novocaine and liquid Novocaine and things to numb the pain. So they use that as a means of just buying themselves some time and getting Higgins to reveal where he kept the map. And again, you see Griffin be true to his word. He promises Higgins that he would do whatever he could to help him walk.
Right. Then, now that they've got the map, we finally go and strike gold. And you're starting to see their success. But you don't see it for very long, because now we're going to go back on the ship again and spend way too much time on a boat. I don't understand why. The whole purpose of this, and I know you needed, well, you didn't really need a foil, but I guess you needed a foil, and it's going to be Higgins. You spent all this time developing Jack's determination of joining the gold rush, of Jack developing the character of Bullwhip Griffin. Eric, to your point, failing upwards time and time again. This great moment where Eric and Jack work together and see that their skills, the smarts and the know-it in terms of having to actually mine the gold, they put their skills together and it works. You build to this moment and it lasts maybe 90 seconds of screen time.
Well, the other thing is you don't really get to see it.
Nope.
Because the fact that they are actually obtaining gold is buried within another song. I agree with you. I like how, too, that they also needed... I mean, I'm always a fan of when they do stuff like the Captain Barbossa thing where they have to work with the enemy in order to get ahead, and that's what they've done here. But where it feels really clunky is... You know, again, you lose that thread in the song, but now we've also got another passage of time because they're showing us that a winter has passed. We have entirely lost the thread of Arabella and Quentin. We know that Quentin is supposed to be working with them. We have no idea what's happened to him at this point.
Haven't seen him.
We got one letter home to Arabella in the very beginning where Griffin wrote to her just to say, hey, I have Jack. We're okay. We're in San Francisco. We see nothing of her journey over to San Francisco, which was probably very harrowing. That also gets lost in this song. And that's where we really could have established this passage of time was, you know, you didn't have to see Arabella's entire journey over, but you've set her up as a strong character. So why not see how she was able to handle herself on the trip to San Francisco? Then to your point, when they're back on the boat, okay, now we actually see one of Higgins' disguises come into play. He's caught up with them again. He knows that they have the gold because they're wearing it in money belts on their person so it doesn't get taken, because they've seen that happen on the ship before too, when Quentin's map got stolen. They're leaving town without their partner, again, because we've lost the Quentin thread. And you've got this whole scene where... Higgins knocks Jack into the water because he's got the money belt on. He sinks like a rock, and you've got to let the gold go so that Eric can save him. First of all, I don't buy that Eric isn't strong enough to sort of push him back to the top, even with the gold. They have a lot of gold, but it's little teeny tiny nuggets.
They don't have that
Not
much
enough
gold.
Where it should be weighing you down where you're going to sink.
Yeah, they have little gold nuggets in their pocket, folks.
Exactly. So the point is here, you know, I think they're trying to allude to the lesson of, you know, your greed is weighing you down. Okay, fine. But why now? We're in the middle of the movie. This isn't like a third act aha moment for a character. It just feels pointless that they would do this now. But they had to have a way to get them back to San Francisco because, oh, wait, Arabella's there now.
Yes and no. And I'll talk about Arabella in a minute. They could have just as easily, because they do talk about how they need to leave because the mine is dried up. So they've already tapped out that mine. So whatever they have is whatever they have. It's enough to get them started. It's not enough to set them up permanently. So you could have just as easily had them keep their gold, dry up the mine, go back to reconvene with Quentin C to figure out what they can do next, and he still has to be in this prize fight. To your point, they lose everything they worked for, your greed's dragging you down. Okay, fine. The fact that Higgins is involved, okay, fine. But I feel like they did all of that simply to put him in this prize fight, which I think he probably would have been in anyway. And I think part of the prize fight is about setting them up financially, but it's also about everything that happens with Arabella as soon as she gets to the saloon. So here's the deal. To your point, we don't get to see her journey over. We know she's very independent. Not only do I like the fact that they don't make her the damsel in distress as she's being gawked at and catcalled by all of these gold diggers
that have been out there with like no women to this point.
But she likes it. This to her is fun. She's a performer. She wants to do this. She wants to be front and center. She wants to be on a stage. She doesn't want to be, you know, she doesn't want to be rescued. I like the fact that she's not a reluctant talent. You see that in so many. It's, well, I have to do this. What else am I going to do? She wants to do it.
No, and I don't think that this was her having aspirations of, you know, heading out west to be a singer or an actress. I think it was just, you know, they do sort of set up that conversation while when she gets the initial letter, letting her know that Jack is okay. She's talking to, I forget the character's name in this movie, but it's Ellen from Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ellen is horrified of what, how could you go out there? And she was like, I have nothing here. So why not? She totally embraces the adventure. And I like that she lands on her feet and she proves that she's able to take care of herself. Because I think, you know, they sort of allude to when Sam, the bar owner, says, you know, you can stay here. I think the idea is that she's performing in exchange for the roof over her head.
Right.
Because there's nothing either that, you know, I mean, like he makes a couple of passes at her, but there's nothing alluding to she's shacked up with him or anything like that. She's entirely independent. And, you know, she's just sort of taking all of these advances from everyone with a grain of salt, but she's not, you know, she's not offended by anything. She knows that like this sort of is what it is, but she's not going to take anyone's crap. And she's also got Mountain Ox there who is protecting her, which I sort of like the way that that relationship is set up. And then it gets turned on his head because now it's going to he's got to fight her real love interest.
Right. So we get her now in the saloon, the reunion with her and Jack and Eric. Eric now sees everything that she has become. He is infuriated.
He's horrified that she showed a little ankle.
Yeah, but it's 1849, right?
That was a lot then.
That was a lot. Gleefully, as I pointed out, I like that they went in this direction. I do like that it turns everything on its head with Ox. And there's also a moment, she's not shacking up with Sam, but it does seem like they have some sort of business relationship here to the point where you're not even sure how much you can trust her.
Yeah.
Like, the whole thing keeps you guessing. And again, this is where the pacing and the screenwriting is very, very good.
It is, but there is something that feels a little muddy to me because you're reading this as business is booming in this town because when Griffin and Jack get back right before they're reunited with Arabella. His plan was to go back, do more haircuts so that they would have enough money to get by until they could go and find more gold, link up with Quentin again, whatever it is that they're going to do. But now you see a barber is set up with a brick and mortar and the haircuts are going for 50 cents. I sort of started reading this as a supply and demand issue, is that this town has been bombarded with people and now there's a settlement there, but there's no gold to keep them there. So it almost sort of felt like the town was drying up, which contradicts the idea that they're putting all of their money on this bet and that people are still, you know, if times are hard, the saloon is going to be the first thing to go.
I don't think so, because guys still need a place to drink. They still need a place to go see dancing girls. That there are certain industries that in this country will never go out of business. I don't need to tell you what they are, but guess what? They're never going to go out of business, no matter what the economy does. I look at that, and I believe that the barber even goes so far as to say, I have to charge 50 cents for haircuts because I'm competing with other barbers now. That's the thing. Other businesses have set up as this San Francisco is starting to expand because of the influx of people.
I thought it was only 50 cents because it's not a commodity anymore.
No, it's supply and demand, but there's more demand. There's more supply than there was before, so you have to compete with your...
you have to compete with your competition.
But that's what it is.
Okay, but what is sort of making it convoluted is that they've established that there is no more gold. So
yes.
Your source of income to pay for all of these things now that all of these businesses have popped up, there is still a sense of the town is drying up. But it really it's the gold source.
And maybe that's a weak point in the screenwriting. I don't know. One weak point in the pacing here, though, is that Arabella didn't need two songs. One was enough. They gave her two. Again, like, there are 3 minutes here, 2 minutes here, 5 minutes here. This movie should not have been more than an hour and 25 minutes. You could so easily trim the fat off of this movie, and it would work so much better.
I agree. But I do really like the slower song that she sings. You know, if this was her movie and it was solely focused on her, this would have been like the I Want song where you fall in love with her at the beginning. Because you do. She totally wins you over now. But I like that they set up how strong she is and that she's already won us over before she sang about it. But I agree. Didn't need two songs, pick one or the other. As fun as this scene is, and then the fight is really what drags for me. Full disclosure, the first time that we were watching this, admittedly, we started it after you got home from work, which is not something that we typically do, but we started it at like 11 o'clock at night, and I totally nodded off. And when I woke up, not that I was out for that long, but they were still fighting.
It
so you can imagine
really
my shock.
Bad. Really bad.
The one thing I will say, though, there's a lot of fun physical comedy. Not as fun as, say, like the absent-minded professor when they're doing the basketball scene and everybody's, you know, leaping 8 feet into the air. I think they do try some of that here because they have Roddy McDowell suspended for some of it. But all of the cutaways to the crowd shots of like your main cast, everybody is just inhabiting their characters so well, top to bottom, from Sam to Mountain Ox to Arabella and Jack to Quentin because he's back now. Like
yeah.
Everybody is just like just on point.
Yes. And it makes all of the sense in the world that Higgins is also there looking to steal the prize receipts. Like, it's so on brand. So everybody ends up where they're supposed to, but you're right, everybody's still doing the things that they're supposed to, quote unquote, supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I just feel like they must have spent a lot of time together at this point, too, because it just feels like a really well-gelled ensemble cast here. And Higgins tracks, because the last time we saw him, he escaped the noose and he was running away on the horse. So he could have been anywhere through the winter.
Yeah.
So I buy it. And then, you know, he's ready to make his escape. He's got the mule packed up with the entire purse, which everybody's paid in gold. So naturally, there's a fire.
Like you do.
I mean, that's kind of a given in a film like this, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're going to burn the Western set down. It makes all of the sense in the world. What doesn't make sense to me is that out of nowhere, like, I know it's his good-hearted nature, but where is all of a sudden Bullwhip building San Francisco? Where did this come from? Where is this affinity for the town? He only uses it as a means to an end. So I don't understand where that came from. Like, this all just seemed like we need to finish the movie and make him a folk legend. Sure, let's do this.
Right, because Sam and Ox sort of get their comeuppance because their purse is taken. They're betting, obviously, they're in favor of Mountain Ox winning. And they're also going to swindle people out of their money because they made the odds so high. So you're on board with Higgins stealing all of it so that they get their due. We see Higgins run away from the angry mob and lock himself in a jail cell. he's still there while the town is burning. We never really see him get his comeuppance, and you don't see him die either, which, not that I think that would have been a little bit too drastic for a movie like this where you don't want to see the villain burn to death, but like, you really don't know what happens to him. And then you see everybody convene at the mule that's still packed with the gold. I think, is it Jack or Quentin that finds him? Doesn't matter. You know that Griffin and Jack and Arabella are going to be okay. You know that Griffin is accomplishing his goal of setting, you know, his charges up. And now they have sort of confirmed the romantic interest because Arabella has kissed him during the fight to revive him. So you're good with the three of them. You even get Ox have a moment of character development where he tells Sam, I'm not working for you anymore. And he's now reporting to Arabella. And you almost sort of get the impression that they're going to like split the pot and square everything away so that Sam can rebuild. And I mean, you do need this business in the town. So, okay, fine. But I think that that's far too much of a leap into he saved the city of San Francisco and built it up to what it is that we know now. That just seemed like it seems like once again, he failed up into that situation.
Let's talk about our cast and our characters here, starting with Roddy McDowall as Eric Bullwhip Griffin. I totally see the pitch. I see the pitch. We have a prim and proper butler that becomes a Western hero. It has to be Roddy McDowall. I see the pitch. I see the appeal. It's also incredibly perfect casting. Roddy McDowall is one of my favorites and was spectacular in this movie. I like the character that he plays. I think that Eric is Eric from start to finish. He doesn't deviate. He doesn't really change, so to your point, he doesn't really have a character arc, but he's consistent. And I like the fact that he, at no point does he trail off, at no point does he become greedy, because I think that that's, a, you know, that becomes passé, right? We just talked about it last week with Hannah Montana, right? You know, she wanted the double life, and then all of a sudden was Hollywood, 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 and got away from the exact thing that she was trying to do. In this case, Eric is at least the same from start to finish. Sometimes you need a character arc. Sometimes you don't. In this case, did you need it? I don't know that you did. I think that's also because all of these characters are one-dimensional. But I still like the character, love the talent.
To that point, I'm glad you bring that up because blanket statement about all of these characters, they are archetypes. That's the thing. They are archetypes of this genre, which is great, but you didn't write enough to break them out of the mold and really give us a reason to root for them. They're not unlikable characters, but because they don't really, you know, they're not really reluctant. That's the thing with Griffin, right? He's not a reluctant hero. He just kind of goes with the flow. And that's why we needed more, like I said in the beginning, of Jack built up the reputation. And now you need to either embrace that and rise to the challenge and prove to yourself that you can do it, which they sort of do with the fight. But they could have also gone the route of he wants to do everything but be this version that Jack has built him up to be. And he resists it throughout the course of the movie, but then at the end, he realizes he's still got to step up, and he just needed to make that decision. He needed to grab it, and he never does because he just keeps tripping into it. With all of that being said, I think Roddy McDowall was perfect because I love him as the prim and proper butler. I like him as Griffin, not so much as Bullwhip. But where I don't like him as Bullwhip, it has more to do with the way that the character's written than the performance, because I think he's great. And I was so blown away by the physical comedy.
Brian Russell plays Jack Flagg. I like Brian Russell in this. I like the childish whimsy that he brings to the film. I like his determination, and I like Jack as a character. I like, as I stated earlier, he wants to go forge his own path. he wants the adventure. He's what every 12-year-old kid wants when they think about adventure. And whether it be him or whether it be, you know, in Treasure Island and swashbuckling, it's just he wants the adventure and he's not afraid to seek it.
I'm very glad that you bring up Treasure Island because that's what Jack reminded me of the most. And actually, I had said that to you was that this was Bobby Driscoll when Bobby Driscoll couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
If he had not aged out of the role and gotten into other things, this would have been tailor-made for him. What I really like about this character is that Jack really is the only one that pushes this story forward. And not just in the ways of plot device. Out of everyone who is an archetype, I think Jack really is like the only one where they did sort of try to write out of that and make him a little bit more developed because he is the champion of everyone, whether it's Eric or Arabella or Quentin too.
Right.
So I definitely like that about him. My only critique is what I mentioned before, and I don't want to be too hard on a child actor, but the delivery of the line, Judge Higgins, it is the same every single time. My Lord, give it a little bit of variation.
Let's talk about Judge Higgins, played by Carl Malden. Hollywood royalty. He's a legend. This is the thing, like, if you look at this, you look at the cast, some of your top billing, it's stacked top billing. I really love the character.
Me too.
We don't get enough of him scheming. That's the problem.
That's the most interesting part of the story. Yeah, and it's all buried in the songs or just because he keeps popping back up. I want to see how he got there. I want to see him duping more people in order to reconvene with Jack and Eric. I would have been on board with an entire like spinoff of Higgins. And you know, that's the other thing too. I couldn't help but wonder, like, are you really a judge? Probably not.
Like Judge Doom.
There's just so much to bite into here. And that's the only thing that bothers me is like, I enjoyed every second that he was on screen, but like, there are so many unanswered questions and the character's so great. You don't necessarily need them answered, but like, I just could have seen more where this film dragged in so many places. I wish it would have dragged with him and more backstory.
He could have been another Doc Terminus, right? Like,
yeah,
that's and he should have been. So where they chose to drag scenes out, I'm not repeating myself again. Suzanne Plachette plays Arabella Flagg. Remember her from the Bob Newhart show. So again, like, at the, you know, kind of earlier in her career, before that show, before she really took off and was very, very famous. But she's great. I love the character. I think they could have done a little bit more with her, but I don't think the film is hurt by not doing more with her.
I mean, what I really appreciate more than anything else is that they did write her as a strong female and she wasn't that damsel in distress. I'm glad that that's our gripe and it's not you wasted an opportunity with her. You know, she had such little screen time and you didn't do anything with it. She had, I think, a fair amount of screen time except for sort of losing her thread for a little bit. But I don't feel like she was in it for the sake of we need a woman in this movie. I love the character. I think she's absolutely gorgeous. I love the hairstyle. I love the costume. I love the portrayal. I love everything about Arabella. And apparently Disney did too, because this was her first foray with Disney. She comes back as Zira in Lion King,
right,
which I was shocked to find out.
I mean, super progressive for a movie that's nearly 60 years old.
Yeah.
That's what they did with that particular character. Quentin Bartlett, he is played by Richard Hayden. Other than providing a map, this character's useless. I hate to say it, because when he is on screen, he's very funny.
Mm-hmm.
This character serves absolutely no purpose.
I mean, I appreciate the comedy. He was supposed to be the comic relief because he keeps getting duped by Higgins. When they set up in the town and Eric has the idea of, you know, to cut hair, he you know, gets up on a platform and he starts, you know, people will pay for Shakespeare. So I love the delusions of grandeur with him, but I feel like we could have played that for comedy a lot more instead of losing him. I think he would have been a great foil. Being that you didn't play Griffin as the fish out of water, I think it would have been great if Griffin is trying to keep Jack at bay from running off on an adventure while he's also trying to wrangle Quentin, who is completely out of his depth. And it would have made Griffin stronger for it, because now he's got to be the de facto leader of this group. I think Quentin could have served this story in a lot of other ways. But it was very cool to see the actor on screen who voiced the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland. I recognized the voice right away, and I was like, "That's really cool that Disney put him in another film."
Mike Mazurki plays Mountain Ox. I wish that they would have done a little bit more with this character, because this character works as a foil. You could have done more comedy with him. He could have been Seabass, right, from Dumb and Dumber, where he's a foil that just keeps coming in and out at these opportune moments.
Mm-hmm.
Just when you've forgotten about him long enough, here he comes again, and you're like, oh, this guy again. Like, it could have worked. It should have worked. They could have done more. It's fine where they went with it, but if they're looking to play for comedy, I wish they would have done more with him.
Could they have, though? Because what I do appreciate is that he wasn't the henchman to Higgins. You know, I like that he wasn't the hired muscle. I mean, he was for Sam, but I like that that's all part of the business entity. And especially I thought it worked with him being Arabella's sort of guardian, too. I just wish that they wouldn't have dumb down his dialogue so much. I wish that instead of, you know, like playing the goof and knowing that he was the hired muscle and not thinking of himself more highly than that, I wish we would have gotten a fully fleshed out character in him.
Harry Guardino plays Sam Tribble. He owns the saloon. He's not a shyster, but he's a very good businessman. He's always looking to make a buck.
He's a little shrewd.
He's shrewd, but it makes sense. I think the casting was good. Could he have been anybody? Maybe. But I think that he worked. I think he worked as casting. I think he worked as a character.
Oh, I loved him. I liked the character a lot, and I loved the portrayal. Like, to me, he felt like the most developed, even though, you know, he is sort of that stereotypical saloon owner businessman, and he is making passes at Arabella. He felt the most grounded to me out of everyone.
Final thoughts on the adventures of Bullwhip Griffin?
I'll go first because I can keep this pretty short and sweet. I feel like, based on the title alone, because it is sort of a zany name for a movie and not knowing anything about it, you and I probably would have eventually picked this for a What the February. And I feel like we go into What the February with sort of, well, at least I do, sort of a negative connotation. And it's like, okay, surprise me here. And this would have, actually. But I'm glad instead that we landed on it for a roulette, because I was definitely able to appreciate it for what it is. You know, it didn't completely win me over in the same way that Apple Dumpling Gang did, not just based on something of this genre. I just think Apple Dumpling was so much more charming than this is. But that's not to say that I didn't like it. I enjoyed it. I don't think that it's a great movie, and it's probably not something that I'm going to rewatch a lot just because of all of these pacing issues. But for something of this era and something that came out, you know, after Walt passed away, this is better than I thought for 3 years after Mary Poppins without Walt. You can still feel his presence here, but you can also feel the lack of his presence. So not bad, but not great.
I would categorize this movie as fine. It's an in-the-middle kind of movie. Does it have a ton of rewatchability? I don't think so. I think it's worth at least one viewing. this will be one that I'll go back and revisit in a few years. It'll likely be something where, like, we leave Big Thunder at Magic Kingdom, and I'm jonesing for this kind of movie. It'll be this. It'll be Apple Dumpling, just because I'm in the mood for it. In all likelihood, my stance on it may soften a little bit, but probably not by much. I think that there are times where it works so well, but for its flaws, it drags the rest of it down. All of the good that it does is dragged down, not completely washed away, but dragged down by a lot of the structural and pacing mistakes that they make. I love the cast. I like the characters. I like the parts more than I like the sum. But we are interested in knowing what you have to say about the adventures of Bullwhip Griffin. You can let us know your thoughts by joining the conversation on all major social media platforms at Monoreal Radio, or you can email us monorealradio@gmail.com. News of the Week is coming up, but first a quick break.
News of the Week is proudly sponsored by KMV Travel. KMV Travel is a boutique travel agency that helps families plan personalized vacations and create unforgettable memories on land and at sea. If you've dreamed of setting sail on the Disney fleet, KMV Travel will help you from booking to bon voyage. When you connect with a KMV Travel specialist, they will not only assist you with your cruise package, but they will also help you with your stateroom selection, pre- and post-cruise accommodations, ground transportation, onboard activity reservations, and port activity reservations. Whether you are traveling as a couple, with a family, or a large group, your KMV Travel advisor will help you customize the perfect cruise itinerary for you. Visit KMV Travel to set sail now.
Hey guys, my name is Mike. I listen to Jackie and Sean's podcast every week on my commute into work. So I reached out to Jackie, and she helped me put together the perfect getaway. I did a 4-night Disney cruise ship, and she was able to answer every question that I threw at her. She put together the perfect dates and an insurance plan that made the whole experience stress-free. She was able to help me with little tips and tricks, like you can get a Mickey Mouse bar delivered to you any time of the day. And I think that was a mistake, because now I put about 10-15 pounds on. I'll definitely be using Jackie again in the future. Thanks for everything.
Massive trailer drop this week. We got the Mufasa trailer. I'm surprised that we got it as early as we did, because the movie is still about 8 months away from release. I guess because Disney's going to start releasing its summer slate now-ish. They wanted to get it out there. This is something that I would have assumed would have come closer to the D23 Expo, if I'm being honest with you.
Right, because in light of the strike, like, they're not going to have that much. So why wouldn't you, especially with something as popular as The Lion King, drop it then? I gotta be honest, I kind of forgot about this one, actually. You know, off top, I mean, the big one for me this year is Inside Out 2. And I kind of forgot that this was coming. To me, I hope that they take the next month, 8 months, and they do some work on the CGI, because that's the other thing, to your point. They dropped this trailer, and it doesn't look very complete yet. I don't think that the CGI looks that great. So I'm hoping they tighten that up quite a bit. I'm also curious to see, you know, how they're going to do this. I mean, you definitely get that vibe from Mufasa that he's not just being an overprotective parent. It's that he's seen some ish, and that's why he's very overprotective of Simba. So now we're going to see all of that play out. But, you know, how much material is there for a 2-hour movie? I'm going in to this one with kind of a low expectation.
Well, I think it makes sense that they are setting up the idea that he did not come from royalty himself, and that he had to earn that right as being the Lion King. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I like the fact that they at least have some facial expressions, which I know people had an issue with that in The Lion King, but it's supposed to be a live action version of The Lion King, and typically lions don't smile or have a lot of facial expressions, so I don't know what you were expecting. It looks like they've at least listened to the social media crowd that had something to say about it. We'll see. I don't think the CGI looks great. I don't think it looks awful. Like anything else, my stance is we will see. Thank you all so much for joining us this and every week on Monoreal Radio. Monoreal Radio will always be free, but there are many ways that you can help support the show. Please give us a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join the conversation on social media at Monoreal Radio on all major platforms. Share your favorite episodes with family and friends who may enjoy them. And of course, book your next trip with Jackie. Links to everything can be found at monorealradio.com. We all get one story. Make yours a magical one.
On behalf of Monoreal Radio, we'd like to thank you for joining us. We'll see you at the movies, the stuff dreams are made of.